So maybe continue on with questions about upa-talking. Like yesterday, you mentioned like being self-conscious about upa-talking, and I've definitely found that to be the case, especially in Thailand, where like a sense of personal space and things like that were different culturally. And also too, like sometimes being upa-talking, we're asked to do things, or it's like part of the upa-talking culture to do things for the senior monk that like he could do for himself. In fact, sometimes he could do better for himself.
Oh yeah.
So
absolutely,
it's part of.
I know it very well. But yeah, I mean, a lot of it is really around that sense of self. So much of the practice in terms of understanding dukkha is it's all around me. So you know, I mean, even if the Ajahn can do it better, it's still a beautiful gesture to help and to assist, and to, you know, so much of it is around giving, you know, in terms of, and there's a giving in so many different ways, you know, like it's not, giving is not just a material thing, but a giving of attention, a giving of care, a giving of service, a giving of, so that you know, so much of the practice, you know, even though we talk about relinquishment a lot, and quite rightly, but part of, one of the things that allows us to relinquish is the way that we've been willing to give, and it's because they're very kind of wedded. In they might appear to be opposite sides of the coin, but they're very wedded together in the sense of being able to, that sense, that gesture of being able to give of oneself, to give of attention, to give to one has to overcome a sense of self. Concern or self-cherishing, and in both senses, both in terms of relinquishment as well as giving. So those are very important complements to each other, and tap into the same kind of source of being able to step beyond that sense of me, and that sense of me always sets up boundaries and usually protective boundaries, and when we give, I mean, there is a real sense of satisfaction and joy when we're able to give in various ways, and to be to help another human being. So it brightens the mind. So it's very, very, very helpful in that way. And you know, I think that sort of you know, for within Thai culture, then a giving is something that is that you learn from the time you're very little, and you see it all around you all the time, and so it's a so it's whereas. For us, it tends to be a bit more somehow structured and you know, it's like America is one of the most, in terms of generous, in terms of donating to, say, like to nonprofits, to things that are when there's need, when there are to hospitals, to schools. There is a strong sense of the benefit and on a certain level duty of giving, but it tends to be structured more, and so so being able to learn how to have a spontaneity in giving and not necessarily having it all rationally laid out for one is really, really important.
I find that very helpful in part maybe because like I ran into this a couple times where it would be people would ask like how like that when in the Asian countries and even here the word dana almost means food given to monks. And so it's like, how can you practice dana as a monk? There, you can't give food to monks because you're already a monk. So the dana sounds like it's more like a mindset in some ways.
In some ways, it is more of a mindset. I mean, it is that character. I mean, it's a barami. And you know, when you think of these are internal qualities that we cultivate in terms of giving. So giving it just takes on so many nuances, and it's just like when we chant, it's like we can chant because we have to, you know, or we can chant because of, you know, the others are chanting, and you know, or we can. Or we can chant because it's been however many years and I still haven't learned it and it's starting to get a bit embarrassing. You know? or we can chant as an offering to the refuges, the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, recollection, a dedication to you know, whatever beings there are, and it turns into it can be a catalyst for very beautiful mind states, and so that because it's approached with a sense of giving. And similarly, that just, you know, that, or say like around upatthakin, or so many of our, because it's not just upatthakin, because once you start, it's like upatthakin is then you start to get, oh, all right, there are actually other human beings besides me, and They actually require some attention and then it can start, and that quite naturally starts to spread out to others. So that, and then that's an opportunity for giving. Like the whole point, like one of the ways a community functions very smoothly is when people do approach the sense of okay, yeah, we're living here in this place and things need to be done, to be looked after and cared for, and you know, I've got some energy, I've got some skill, I've got some time, and I can help. And then learning how to keep one's eyes open for, okay, what actually does need to be done, what can be accomplished. Just remember reading in the very, very old biography of Ajahn, very first kind of biography of Ajahn Chah, was just kind of a tiny thing, and that one of the first, there were three disciples who came and stayed and kind of laid the foundation for Wat Bapaum to grow, and one of them, and I guess two out of three ordained elsewhere and then came to stay with Ajahn Chah. So one of them, Ajahn Sinowen, came and he comes into the monastery and he was just really impressed and inspired at how neat and tidy the monastery was and how the paths were swept pretty clean. And he was sort of, oh, this is really... You know, this is really impressive, and so this, you know, the paths are all, you know, so clean. And how did that happen? And you know, Ajahn Chah's are, oh yeah, they sweep themselves. You know, people pitched in and swept the paths and looked after things and. And that's, you know, that's how it works for everything. And then that is an opportunity for dana and giving. And it's, if it's because if the monastery runs on some kind of the Ajahn just on everybody's case to all the time, do this, do that, you have to get this. It doesn't really, it's not a happy place to be. And so then practice isn't so happy. So there's, you know, you see something like a simple quality like dana and using those that sense of care and attention to others and the opportunity to help, then that it creates an ease of mind that isn't self focused and self obsessed, that leads to a real ease for meditation and practice. These things work together. That's the monastic form is really one that lays a foundation for many aspects of our being to be trained, and it takes time to be cultivating that and to be reaping the fruits of that.
So you touched on two, I think, hallmarks of the Thai forest tradition, and I think especially of Lungpa Cha's flavor, and those were like the communal practice of the pujas, and also like the communal chore periods and the working together. And maybe if we could explore like how those things, because like somebody was asking the other day about maybe those things were unexpected for many of us coming to the monastic form, mm-hmm. and even things like the chanting and bowing, there may even be sort of previous sort of baggage with those things and working and understanding how they function in the practice.
Yeah, I think it's just recognizing that it is a convention. it isn't an ultimate truth. But conventions are helpful if they're used skillfully. So that using the bowing, and that's Ajahn Chah's, you know, use the bowing as a means of establishing mindfulness, of stopping. So you go into a hall, and rather than just sort of kind of rushing in and plopping yourself down, you go into the hall and you stop, and you bow. And then you leave the hall, rather than, oh, I got to leave, and you rush off. You stop and you bow. And it's an opportunity for stopping. And that stopping is really an important part of practice, that learning how to stop. Because that is a wedge into the momentum of the mind that is becoming, and so creating those opportunities for stopping in various ways. Chanting is one of them, or rather, bowing is one of them. So that bowing and this, and how Ajahn Chah would say, yeah, you go back to your kuti, and you put your stuff down, or you bow, just, you know, having a shrine. So then what you're doing is, rather than creating a, you start to relate to your space a bit differently than it's just your kind of hangout spot in the forest. To a place of it's a shrine, and then you're reflecting on, you know, okay, this was offered for through the faith and generosity of the lay community in order for me to practice Dhamma, and that bowing is also an acknowledgement of that offering of generosity and faith that the lay community has, that they make an offering to the monastery, and the people who live there are going to use it to further their spiritual practice. And so then it's both a certain establishing of respect and gratitude, as well as stopping, slowing down, and not just impulsively, coming back or going out again, but just collecting oneself, gathering oneself together, composing oneself, and bowing, using the bowing to help to do that, because it's physically you have to stop and compose the mind, and then it's a respectful gesture. And then it changes the mental state, changes that momentum of the mind in a very skillful way. So those are, and bowing is something that Ajahn Chah really put a lot of emphasis on. He emphasized a lot on just, you know, paying bowing to the senior monks, and oftentimes in many monasteries they might not, if they bow to anybody, it would just be the one sort of one senior monk, and then it's sort of like almost like you got to earn it to, and Ajahn Chah was sort of, no, it's not personal. It's just paying respects to the form, and then using it as a way of cultivating that sense of respect and gratitude. I can remember one time, a Westerner came to Wat Pa Pong and was staying there for a little while, and then asked Ajahn, just really in a very irritated way, you know, why do we have to bow so much? I mean, it's just, it seems so unnecessary to have to bow all the time. And Ajahn Chah said, yes. He said, that's good exercise. You keep, get you in good shape. It's good for your digestion. Just do it. Sidestep the whole thing.
One more?
Yeah.
I've heard you mention before that a monastic has the opportunity to be a field of merit, and I wondered if you could clarify what that means.
Well, it's like when somebody makes offerings to the Sangha and to the that that's part of that chanting of in the Punya Ketang in the recollection of the Sangha, and it's like a field of blessing. So that when and if it's a well conducted, well practiced Sangha, and people make offerings to support it or draw close to it, when they think of it, it uplifts, think of it in Sangha or them as members of Sangha, then their hearts kind of brighten thinking of that. And that's a feel, one is creating blessings, and it's a meritorious action to draw close and to be supportive, and so that it's something that brings blessings into the world, or brings meritorious deeds into the world, or meritorious mental states into the world. And that's so much of the world brings up fear, competition, greed, irritation, aversion, and it's not very meritorious. Not many blessings with that. So that being living with precepts and training and mindfulness and discernment, to some degree, it brings goodness into the world, and whoever draws close is going to be affected in a positive way. So that again, that's a gift to the world.
Maybe I'll pass on a question that Thun Pumuto and I received on alms round many years ago. Uh-huh. It was a man who was in conversation. He was very very Protestant, and he basically very pointedly asked us, "What's with all the images?"
Oh, right.
Like why do you bow to images?
Oh well, I mean, one is they're just reminders of wholesome qualities. I mean, they're it's very human. It's certainly not something that's say inherent in the Buddha's teachings or in the Buddha's say the history of Buddhism is such that the early years that really didn't the Buddha would he'd probably be appalled seeing, but I mean he would just say, okay, yeah, well there it is again, humans, but the early probably first few hundred years 300 to 400 years, and there weren't any images. And it was the Greeks, really, who started it, because in their religion, that what was really important was the actual manifestation of the gods. So the first images of Gautama the Buddha were styled after Apollo, who was the Greek god of wisdom. So it's appropriate. But I think it caught on like wildfire. You know, I just think it's quite human to want to have something a bit tangible that you can abstract, and but it was also one of the things of, say, coming to America, knowing that, you know, I've tried to put a lot of attention on trying to have, you know, quite peaceful images and something that people would be happy to at least sit and look at, if not bow to, in that there. Because there's a lot of really ghastly images out there, it would just irritate me to no end having to bow to them every day. So having some kind of aesthetic, some pleasing aesthetic qualities is nice, and that and it does set a tone for a space. I think when people walk into our halls or are up at the ordination hall, when they come into that space, it settles things, and people feel something. That at least it's a place of peace or respect. So those are they're ways of, and of course the images are stylized, and for the most part it's really interesting that the images are mostly with the Buddha with his eyes open. He's not sort of eyes open, sort of looking around here and there, but he's not shut down, closed off, inaccessible. It's like he's awake, and that's a really important symbol to be brought into the world. That you don't transcend the world through escaping, getting away from it, or not dealing with it. You escape the world, transcend the world through being fully awake, and that's a really important signal. So to be able to physically manifest that is a helpful tool, Buddha images are, there is certainly in Thailand, there's all sorts of images that people pray to and do all sorts of things that like Western Buddhists would find, really, do Buddhists do that? They'd be kind of shocked at it. But definitely. And, they take on a whole different kind of power and mythology. But that's not what we're trying to introduce. But it is a Nika can be, it's a helpful symbol to remind one of the qualities of the Buddha.
One more?
Yeah.
Kind of related to that, I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the relics. Because I know, like, in traditional Buddhist countries, like the Buddha images, those take on all kinds of mythology and things like that. But I was just wondering how you understand and what your kind of thoughts about enshrining the relics. So.
Well, I don't know. You know, in the sense that there's something different about it. But there's also, you know, I've just had so much experience, but I try not to make too much of a, say, too mystical, kind of woo-woo out there. But, yeah, there is something that is kind of different, and trying to come up with some scientific explanation is just frustrating, but not making it too, you know, just sort of saying, yeah, there something's out of the ordinary. And it can't, yeah, not looking for an explanation or not looking for some sort of special, 'cause we've got a lot of relics, but, you know, don't really draw a whole lot of attention to them. I don't throw them away either, so. But you know, there is a so both in terms of, say, relics that are purported to be of the Buddha, manifesting on their own, you know, it happens. Or the, say, the ashes or cremated remains of somebody who's considered to be enlightened, changing their. Yeah, it's just something different. You know, why it's that, I have no idea. But it does seem to be a possibility, and different. Just the different ways that they appearances, how they appear, so that. Say, like Ajahn Mun's relics, especially the ones, like I saw his relics in probably 1976. I've never gone back. But I saw his relics in 1976 at Watsuda Wat, where he was cremated. And they had a shrine and a jetty for him, and they had some. I mean, it's hard to make a museum out of these forest monks' stuff because they didn't have much. But you know, well, the focal point in the feature is their relics, and with Ajahn Mun's, you could really see very clearly where the bone was changing to very clear crystal, and I don't know what they're like now, in terms of, have they all changed a very clear crystal of there? But it's very, you could see where it was bone turning to very, very clear crystal. We've got a relic of Lumpu Khao. It's up in the behind the Buddha image and up at the ordination platform. And there's his were very, very beautiful. They're kind of like an amethyst, or like a purpley color. They're quite clear, but kind of an amethyst color. And why that's like that, I don't know. Or seeing pictures of like Meiji Gao, very beautiful relics. Master Hua, his are really variegated and have almost like a jade-like quality to them. Ajahn Chah's very different. His weren't small, they were kind of almost like coral, kind of large and they're quite different. Who knows? I mean, he always did things different. And then how relics can multiply story I'd like to tell is about my mom. She is one of the most practical. She's definitely not sort of California woo-woo. when my dad was very ill, and I went back first time, and as I was leaving, Ajahn Mahaamon knew I was going back to visit my dad. I didn't know exactly how he was, because he had kidney failure and going to see how he was doing. And so he gave me, I can't remember, it was 5 or 7 relics. He said, give this to your parents. So I went back and I told my parents, these are Buddha relics and given by a very senior monk, disciple of Ajahn Chah, very concerned for you. And he said, and they said, well, what do we do with these? I said, well, put them in a high place. Don't put them in a low ordinary place, or put them in a place of respect. Put them in a place where you have other things that you have some respect for, keep good sila, keep good precepts, and take care of them, and my mom took them from, it was one of the things that she, she kept sort of getting rid of stuff all the time, it'd be about 5-6 years ago, I was at my sister's, and my mom kind of pulled me aside from the, because my sisters and nieces and nephews are all sort of brothers and whatnot, siblings, or it was a gathering, and pulled me aside, and she's, "What's with these relics?" I said, "What do you mean, what's with his relics?" "Well, I looked after them just like you said and kept them, and I opened I opened. I haven't haven't looked at them for years. And one day I was cleaning, and I thought, opened them up and took a look, and there was a whole bunch in there. I said, well, that's a good thing. I said, you just keep looking after them, you keep the precept, because they can disappear as well. So yeah, they're who knows what that this is one of the more unlikely candidates, but you know.
Lumpa, what do you think might have happened to the few minuscule relics that I had in my house when they were burned? Does anyone know where they go or what happens to them?
It's the great reliquary in the sky. The great repository, getting recycled to show up in my mom's. Yeah, who knows? I bet, like up at KPY, they probably have lots of relics up there. And I think everything was pretty devastated and went into ash. And I doubt that they would melt or anything, but they'll probably just go back into the earth element. Who knows? I mean, this is not a scientific phenomenon.
Well, it's still sort of nice to think that they might still be there, and
yeah, absolutely. They just sort of filter down into the ground there. Okay.